Welcome to Good Areas Live. Jared Kimber here for the Wagon Wheel Podcast, the show where we answer your questions on cricket. If you're live on the YouTube, the best way to ask these questions is via the Super Chat. But the vast majority of the people go over and support us at Patreon, which is a Good Areas podcast for Patreon. You can find us all over there and you can ask questions. You get access to Discord, everything else. This is still basically a fan-led community as much as it is helped by sponsors. So if you want to ask a question or you just want to help out, those are the best ways of doing it. Like Hertz has, who says, all news leaks about Saudi Slam, renewed Champions League, two-tier proposal, etc. died down in the last few months. Anything you could share around these that is going on in your cricket Illuminati circles? So it's very important to understand why they all came out at the same time, and also very important to understand why they've all gone quiet. These events, they don't actually, people in world cricket don't meet up all that often, right? You know, you're talking about people, it's not like, I don't know, something like football, right, where it's very, very European and they can meet up quite regularly. So they go off to these big events and we hear a bunch of stuff and then it all dies down. That's a very, very normal thing to have happen. I think there's still definitely, Saudi Arabia will be involved in cricket one way or another going into the future. I don't think there's any doubt on that. What level that will be, I have no idea. Champions League, I haven't heard much about that. A two-tier proposed is still something that they're talking about. It's still definitely on the board. But it's just that they're not talking as much at the moment. Before the next meeting, they'll start talking a lot again. And that's generally how these things happen. Lemon says, only one current test captain is left-handed. Do you think there is any bias at all towards right-handers for captaincy? Yes, I do. I think the left-handers are generally seen as lower human beings. No, it's probably dumb luck, right? I would say that traditionally you were more likely to be captain right-handed for two reasons. One, there were a lot more right-handers. And two, there was always a feeling that left-handers actually weren't as talented. And there's still an element of that, but there's so many left-handers in the game anymore. Like, it's far less likely to be the case than ever before. Also, teams are picking left-handers all the time, right? Like, as in, teams are going out of their way to pick left-handers. So even if your player is not quite as good, they might still play longer in their career because they're a left-hander, which makes them more likely to be captain. Is Ben Stokes actually a left-hander? Because he bats right arm. He bowls right arm, sorry. Anyway, food for thought. Cab says, what is it about Australian and English culture that means they have retained Test cricket as the dominant format while other countries have moved towards T20? Is it just down to the draw of the Ashes? I think it's probably ticket sales. I think you can charge. It's an older audience than T20. It's a more moneyed audience. They are more committed than T20 fans. And it's 5 days, right? It's 20, 25 days. So I think it's largely to do with that. The other countries never had the ticket sales and certainly haven't for a very long time. So it's very hard for them to kind of monetize that. Whereas T20 is much more of a TV game, right? You want the crowd in, but the tickets aren't particularly expensive. They might get there one day, especially in the IPL, but the tickets aren't particularly expensive, right? IPL tickets are expensive by Indian standards, but certainly nothing compares to the sheer amount of money that you have to put in for an English game, right? Which is just ridiculous. I've been at like domestic games where they charge £20. It's like, that's more than what you get charged for a test match in Australia. So yeah, I think there's an element of that that plays a part as well. Maybe older societies. I don't know what the ages are. I know that India and Pakistan are both the average ages of a person in those countries is under 30. I would assume that's the case for quite a few other nations. I'm not sure about South Africa, actually. And I would guess that the places where the age limits are slightly older, the average age is slightly older, might favour towards Test cricket as well. Certainly, I'm pretty sure in saying that Australia and England are both over 40, like low 40s maybe. I don't know about New Zealand, actually. But so there's a possibility that plays a part as well. But yeah, they, you know, also, they always made money, those two places, right? A lot of the others did not. Josh says, for New Zealand to have the best possible chance of stealing a T20 World Cup title, do they need to commit to a more aggressive batting lineup, getting rid of Conway, Kane and Mitchell? So Alan, Seifert, Robertson, Ravindra. I think if you look at the history, Josh, of New Zealand cricket, they're probably at their best when they've got a very strong bowling lineup. And if that's the case, you probably want some of the slow starters in there. I don't think they can carry all three of those players. I think Mitchell is probably a must because you can get a couple of sneaky overs out of him as well. Conway, I haven't been tracking his recent form, but I would be very form dependent for Conway if that's the way I would look at it. And Kane, I probably just wouldn't pick for T20 cricket anymore for any league anywhere. Alan Seifert, Robinson, even up to Ravindra, certainly the first three. It's very combustible when you're going up against Bumrah, Stark. Hazelwood, Rabada. You know, any team with Tashara, any team with a good new ball bowler, Shaheen, if he's, you know, back to his best. You've got a bunch of guys there that are not particularly rock solid. And generally in these big World Cups, you need, you know, we've seen over the last couple of years, Ben Stokes, Virat Kohli, I'm trying to think of some of the others, like, you know, just normal innings from top quality international players. They leave themselves really open to that because Ravindra is the only player in that lineup that is probably the player that I'm suggesting there. A little bit harsh on Phillips, perhaps, but probably not. Sashimi says, what is your opinion on Rohit and Virat for 2027? Two of the best ODI players of all time. One's in the top five, top four best ODI bats that's ever lived. The other one's probably in the top, 15 to 17, maybe even higher than that, but certainly in that list. They have played incredible roles of recent times that has also helped the team. I'd be probably going with that, based also on what we just talked about in that last thing of, like, we know they can do it. A lot of it will depend on form, though. If they don't have the form, I think you have a reason to move on. But if they're making runs in ODI cricket, I would assume you would just keep picking them. Karen says, do you keep up with other cricket shows like Cricket Buzz Live, Great Cricketer, or Stick to Cricket? Or are there any other cricket journalists or analysts whose work you personally follow or rate highly? No, I definitely haven't watched Cricket Buzz Live. The Great Cricketer, some of the clips, and Stick to Cricket, some of the clips. Willow Talk with Brad Haddon would be another one that the clips would be probably be something that would come up. I'm trying to think of some of the others. Probably the same with Harmy and Manners. Caribbean Cricket Podcast is probably the cricket podcast I'm most likely to listen to. And there's a reason for that. It's not that I like Mash and Santoki, because obviously I don't. And if anyone says that, they're a damn liar. But it's because there isn't anything to read. It's easier for me to read than listen. And I've tried to come back into basketball via podcast. So my podcasts are all taken up with basketball. Whereas the reason I don't do as much reading on basketball is because all my reading is already done on cricket. So I'm much more likely to read things in cricket than I am to listen. And that's just the way that, I suppose, the algorithm has worked, the way that my timing has worked and everything else. You know, I've got an app called Pocket where I save all the articles. I've probably got 40 to 50 unread cricket articles in there at the moment, right? And I'll power through those at one stage when I'm, you know, on the way to an airport or traveling somewhere or waiting for someone or something like that. So yeah, it's much more likely that I do that than I listen to podcasts. I don't think of it. And Caribbean, I wouldn't say is in my regular rotation. It's just that when there's something I want to follow up, I probably listen to that the most. But yeah, it's mostly the clips of all the other shows in the way that they work. So yeah. Oh my God, Lemon. This is a long one. I understand if you can't read it all the truth. I might not be able to read it anyway. Judging batter's ability, okay? Take the mean of ratios between a batsman's regional average runs per wicket against each bowler that the bowler's regional bowling average. For example, a batter averages 40 in India against bowler A and 35 against bowler B. That means that the runs scored against Jasper Bumrah at the SCG count for far more proportionally than runs scored against Craig Brathwaite on a flat pitch. Thanks for reading this. Hope it makes sense. Yes, there's just better ways of doing this. You can have a look at the record of players ball by ball against each individual bowler. I think we already do something that looks at, you know, what their average is when they're facing bowlers with a bowling average of over 30 compared to under 30. There's, you know, expected averages. There's match factors. There's just better ways of doing what you're trying to do here, I would have thought, with existing information. But yeah, that's what we should be searching for, is a better way to understand how good people are at cricket. Alex says, how big a loss is Cummins to the Ashes? Is Boland coming in actually better for Australia given his record versus England? So Boland got smashed by England the last time we played against them. Smashed out of the Ashes, right? Like, I think people have forgotten that. He really struggled with baseball. I still thought he bowled okay, but the luck went against him. But Australia lost a little bit of confidence in him, I think, based on the way that they were using him in that game. And I do believe people have slept on that. How Boland is going to handle people coming down the wicket to him is probably the big thing for him, if he can handle that. But the thing is that England turned a lot of cricket into white ball cricket, and Boland's not a particularly good white ball bowler. So when things are in his favour, I still expect him to be unplayable. But what's going to happen when people are charging down the wicket or lapping him over their head and everything else? I think that is quite tricky. But no, they are not a better side with Boland in than Cummins. Cummins also gives them batting. Plus, it destabilizes them, you know, in a leadership captaincy strategic. So, no, they're a much better side with Cummins in the side than Boland. I still think that if Cummins doesn't play at all, I'd happy to go back to England being a slight favourite again. I think you only need one other injury to one of the other three seamers at that point, and Australia's drop-off makes them much more similar to England. A lot of this is just going to be if England can make runs, right? If they can work out how to make runs on the kinds of wickets against these kinds of bowlers, they have a very good chance of winning the series. And if they don't, they don't. That kind of works with or without Cummins, because a lot of this is the ball and the pitches as well. Hurt says, if you had to build a T20 squad using the following blocks, each block coming exclusively from a nation and no nation can be used twice, which one do you assign to each block? Six specialist batters. I suppose you just go with India. That's pretty easy. If you're looking for three spinners and you can't use India, you would use Sri Lanka. If you're looking for four pacers, it's T20 cricket, isn't it? I want to say South Africa. Yeah, I think South Africa's right there. Are you looking for all-rounders? Who's got all-rounders? It's probably Narine and Russell, right? I don't know if that counts for you. It's probably Narine and Russell. Who else has... David Visa? No. Yeah, it probably is Narine Russell, if that's what you're going for there. I'm trying to think of any other teams that would have two. What else would you be looking at? I've already used South Africa anyway. Pakistan don't really have anyone that I want necessarily. Bangladesh. Omazai. Do we count Rashid Khan as an all-rounder in that sort of situation? Or Mohammad Nabi? Omazai, Mohammad Nabi, or Narine and Russell? Just depending on how you feel about these things. Coach and support staff, including analysts. Who's the best coach and support staff left? Probably New Zealand or England. Probably England. Yeah, I think because New Zealand's just in the middle of changing, aren't they? So probably New Zealand. Probably England on that one. Sure. Why not? Pav says, given how many matches Kane is missing for New Zealand, do you think he's looking to move on from the side? Would New Zealand look to go in the 2026 World T20 without him? It's a possibility. I don't think he's looking at moving on from the side. I think he's an older cricketer who realizes that he's got to make money New Zealand cricketer is not going to make a fortune after he retires, right? He's not a gregarious person. I know he's looking at a career in media, and it'd be really interesting because he's so smart. It'd be really interesting to see how that goes over, but it's not unnatural that he's going to be good at it. I'm sure he's got other business interests. I can't think of any off the top of my head, but I've got a feeling that he's been involved in some other things. So I just think he's taking the money while the money's on offer, which is a perfectly reasonable thing to do, and that's where the money is at the moment. But yeah, I think regardless of that, New Zealand, even if he was playing, I think New Zealand would be looking at perhaps not playing in the T20 World Cup without him, because he's just not very good at that format of cricket anymore. And you could argue ever, but certainly the way it's played now. Ali says, we often hear about how Pakistani players don't justify their talent. Is that specifically a Pakistani issue? Also, which Pakistani players performed on the field better than their talent suggested? Shamasut. Shoaib Malik probably as well. It's not a specifically Pakistani issue. You can be from any country on earth and have that. The issue in Pakistan is that the way that they look at talent is wrong. It's already flawed because they're looking for a magical person who will come in and be perfect and just be wonderful and that they'll be able to, you know, use for the next 15 years. And that's not how the vast majority, like if you look at the way a Premier League football team is put up or a baseball team, right? And you look at the way that they're structured, they are structured around the fact that they're only going to be able to have maybe two, three, four incredible players at any one time. And there's going to be a bunch of role players. And maybe that player won't be good until they're 25, 26, or maybe they'll be good at 22 to 25, if, you know, depending on the kind of skill set they have. That's how they understand talent. And so they're trying to get players to be ready when they need those spots or to trade for them or everything else. Well, Pakistan is literally like, oh, this guy bowls at 90 miles an hour, let's pick him. Oh, now he's bowling at 87 miles an hour, let's never pick him again. Well, that doesn't make any sense, right? There are plenty of bowlers who've slowed down who've got better, right? And also, he won't, no bowler's going to bowl 90 miles an hour for him. Well, this guy, can, you know, used to hit sixes for all the time and now he's not. Well, he could just be in a funk. It could be a technical thing. So there's huge things there, but there's also the whole development of Pakistani cricket. It's not about developing professional players. It's about looking for a diamond all the time. And if, you know, maybe diamond's the wrong word because diamonds aren't actually that scarce, but you're looking for, they're looking for the a bit of magic when actually the best thing to do is to put everyone in a professional environment, make sure everyone can field, make sure everyone can run between wickets, make sure everyone understands what diet they need to do, how to look after their body, how to look after their mind and everything else. And then when you do that over a period of 8, 10, 12, 14 years, you hope that the magic players will actually pick that up, right? And sometimes they don't. You could argue that Shane Warne maybe didn't, but Glenn McGrath and Ricky Ponting and Adam Gilchrist did, right? And so at any one stage, if you can make a Glenn McGrath better and, you know, more automatic and professional and everything else, isn't that the job? Whereas at the moment, Pakistan is still stuck in this thing of like, we need to find the next big thing, not understanding that actually that's not what you need to do. You need to completely change the entire structure of how you plan and think about cricket to make sure that every single player has the ability to be at least get to the best of their game and even exceed it in some cases. And I think we'd have to all be pretty honest here and say that Pakistan is certainly not doing that and has not been doing that for, you know, a good little while now. So that's where they are at the moment. I once made a pair in a club game, which is almost impossible to do. But I have been obsessed with batting my entire life. And so I put that into my new book, The Art of Batting. Being that I'm not very good at that skill, I decided to talk to other people who were. So I hit up as many contacts as I could just to talk about batting. Rahul Dravid, Brian Lara, AB de Villiers, Kumar Sangakkara, Ross Taylor, Susie Bates, Nasser Hussain, Ian Chappell, and so many, many, many more. I wanted batters to talk about how they and their friends made runs, because that is the art of batting. Mob says, I'm on holiday watching baseball and AFL highlights and the silly uniforms appear functional at sliding and jumping or whatever. It got me wondering, how would Jared Kimber revolutionise cricket uniforms, i.e. the clothes and shoes, not the batter wicketkeeper protective equipment? I think I might have done a short video on this recently. I think it was a New Zealand writer who wrote a whole piece about how cricketers should wear shorts. And I basically pointed out why they shouldn't wear shorts. And it's mostly to do with the pitch and the square. Right. If you were just running around the outfield all day, actually shorts would be okay. But you see why so many players have those like, I know what you call them, the sort of elbow warmers type things, is because those grounds are hard. And if you slide on them, you will get hurt, especially the amount of times that people slide on cricket grounds in modern cricket. So I'm not sure there is something specific that I would change. I've always wondered about sleeves on bowlers. Maybe because I grew up playing Aussie rules football and basketball, where you don't have sleeves, and those are sports where you get your arm above your head. But I have always wondered about sleeves on bowlers of like, is that something we necessarily need? Other than that, I think we've got what we need in cricket. I certainly can't think of anything else, Mob, that would add to the game. Funny hats add to everything. Karen says, if Ravindra Jadeja is able to end his career with a test batting average above 40 and a bowling average below 25, would he be the first to ever do that in the modern era? He wouldn't be the first to ever do that in the modern era. He would be the first to ever do that. No one's done it in any era. The best record of all time, Karen, at the moment, as far as all-rounders, the only player ever to have, I think it's 50 wickets and 500, 1,000 runs. I can't remember how many runs he made. But in a career is Aubrey Faulkner, who has that amount, and he's the only person ever to average over 40 with the bat and under 30 with the ball. So no one has ever done it before. Instantly very, very different. Is a player averaging 40 with the bat and 25 with the ball more valuable than a Sobers or Callis, 55 with the bat and 33, 34 with the ball? I'm leaning towards yes, because on a good team, a Callis and Sobers shouldn't get as many overs as there was Mike Leiby, three or four better bowlers. The issue here is these are three very different kind of bowlers, all-rounders in general. For a great part of his career, this is where focusing on batting averages and bowling averages don't help, because it doesn't tell you the full story of Sobers and why he's a better all-rounder than both these other two. But for a great part of Jadeja's career, he didn't actually help the Indian team as an all-rounder. And by that I mean, he didn't give them the fifth bowling option. That is the most important thing that you can do. Callis does that from day one until basically the last year of his career, I think, maybe a year and a half where he doesn't bowl much. He gives him five frontline bowlers in every single game. It takes Jadeja quite a while to get to that position. And then he spends a lot of time batting at number seven. When you bat at number seven, you are still reliant on a very good wicketkeeper. Again, the reason why Sobers and Callis are more important is they are top six batters of which you lose nothing, and in their cases, actually add. And they are world-class fifth bowlers, right? They would be, I mean, I'll answer the question a little bit more when I talk to the bowling a little bit. Again, that is way more transformative. Like, Sobers comes into the side, he bats in the top order, and they have their team's fifth bowler slash permanent spinner. You know, however they wanted to do it. I think they mostly had another spinner in the games that he played, but he was like the defensive spinner when he first came in. Jadeja's just not doing that. And eventually does it at seven, and now he's doing it in the top six. But a lot of his career, you don't get the all-rounder stuff. So the average I'm not as interested in, because that's about efficiency and it can be about pitches and many other different things, right? Secondly, it's about then how useful you are in multiple situations and where you fit in. One of the incredible things about Sobers is he starts as a fifth bowler and ends as like a third or second bowler, right? So by the end of his career, he's taking the new ball and then coming on quite often as the first or second choice spinner. That gives you so much more than what Jadeja or Callis can ever give you. Callis's numbers are quite interesting because his bowling numbers don't pop. In fact, I'm pretty sure if you did a real thorough analysis, which I think I have for a piece that hasn't come out yet, you can make the argument that even though the averages are way different, I think Sobers' average is 34 and Callis is 31, 32, that Sobers is as good a bowler as Callis, and then more useful because of the other things I just said. So when you're looking at an all-rounder, you're really looking at what they do to your team. If you play with Callis, every single game you play, you have five bowling options available to you if you want them. Or you can bat to number eight, however you want to use that flexibility, right? You have that ability to be able to do that in every single game. But generally, five bowlers is the dream. If you have Ravindra Jadeja, when he eventually gets into that top six, he becomes that guy, right? But for a lot of that time, what you really have is a world-class bowler, great, absolutely fantastic, and a person who makes your batting order a little bit longer, which is helpful, but it doesn't actually make you all that much more likely to win games. Actually, more helps with draws and stuff, but certainly doesn't help you all that much more likely to win games. The best way to win games is to guarantee that you take 20 wickets. If you have five frontline bowlers, you're much more likely to do that than to have a strong number eight, right? Eventually gets to number seven, as I said, and then moves up to number six. Number seven is handy, but it depends on the rest of the lineup. By the time he gets to number six, he's then in the same world as Sobers and Callis, right? And there'll be people who say, well, it's very hard to get into the top six of the Indian side. But it is worth going back and having a look at some of the teams that Callis and Sobers played in. But they were pushing out incredible players out of the lineup. I mean, the West Indies side was absolutely stacked. And Sobers was still in there as a frontline batter. And he would have been even if he didn't bowl. That is not the case with Jadeja. So again, you have a difference there. And then with Sobers, by the end of his career, and this is probably the last 10 years, so it's a decent chunk, certainly the last 8 years, he's your new ball bowler and a very well-respected new ball bowler. The batters who faced him were like, no, he could bowl. And he was your backup spinner. So it means that in any side, you actually have, if you have Sobers, you actually have six bowlers available to you, not five, or at least five and a half. So the extra ability there. Your overall question is more interesting because if Jadeja had batted his whole career at six and had a bowling average of 25, I think you could make a claim that that might be more useful than the sort of Callis Sobers. I think I'd be more interested in, if I knew someone could average 40 with a bat and 25 with the ball, I'd be more interested in picking them than I would someone who averages 55 with the bat and 33, 34 with the ball, if that's your overall question. But if you're asking directly about these players, Sobers is the GOAT for so many different reasons, and one of them is the extra options he gives you. You can go into a game with Sobers and three specialist bowlers and still have five, or you can argue six, but certainly five different bowling types available to you. It's just a freak that we have never really seen the likes of before. Ajit says, how wide do New Zealand always seem to underperform in bilaterals across formats, but then overperform in big tournaments? Is it more or less the same squad that they have in both? So one of the reasons is that generally World Cups are a bit more tense and the wickets are more favored towards bowlers. And generally New Zealand come in without too many weaknesses in their bowling attack, and specifically with them, good new ball bowling. So they quite often get wickets and they get themselves into the games. And then these are lower scoring games. And so if you look at, you know, that sort of Williamson, Taylor kind of period, they had two guys who were obviously well above, you know, normal level of talent, who when the going was tough, were probably going to be able to stick in and stay in, right? And then they always had the bowlers either to back that up, or the bowlers were the ones who got them the low total that they could charge. So there's a, I think there's a technical reason why New Zealand is so good. Maybe also the ability over a long period of time to be maybe more consistent with having all-round talent, which means that they very rarely go in with a very weak number six, number seven, or a very bad fifth bowling option might be another one, but I haven't looked into that one as much. Nadika says, if you were picking an all-time test team to go against another all-time team, would you be comfortable only picking all-rounders for your bowlers, or would you need a couple of specialist bowlers to take 20 wickets? When I'm picking an all-time team, I'm trying to take as many wickets as possible. You can quite easily, though, pick Miller, Imran, Sobers, Jadeja, Shakib, Faulkner, and be like, we've got fast bowling, we've got reverse swing, we've got everything that Sobers does, not conventional swing. So we've got speed, we've got accuracy, we've got skill, we've got three different spinners. And that's probably going to take 20 wickets. I think if I'm going into an all-time draft, I'm probably, and I don't know if I've done one. I must have at some stage. I'm probably going to pick Sobers or Imran near the top, right? I probably pick Bradman, Imran, Sobers. Once I've done that, I kind of figure I've got enough of whatever. Like, once I've got one of Sobers or Imran, I'm in a position where I'm like, well, I'm going to take 20 wickets. And I've also got extra batting, right? So I've got a flexibility with my side at that point to go in either direction when I'm picking the rest of the side. I don't think picking 11 all-rounders is specifically going to help me. There aren't that many all-rounders that can open the batting, for instance. And you're still going to want Murley or Warne or McGrath or Bumrah, right? Or Garner. Whoever that person is, staying, I still think you want a couple of those guys in there. But you can also play around the edges, right? Where, you know, Wasim Akram's a very good person to do that with. Keith Miller is another really good person to do that with. You know, Sean Pollock is another good person to do that. You're not really losing a lot on either side. With Wasim Akram, you still got him as one of the greatest bowlers of all time, but he stacks your batting if you need to stack a little bit more batting in there. Keith Miller is a fantastic bowler and can bat it, you know, number five or number six without too many issues. Certainly be a great number, would have been a great number seven if Australia had ever used him in that role as well. So I think that's the way I would go about something like that. I think they did one the rest of the Crick Picks team, but I don't think I was on that episode. So I'm sure we'll get to it one day. I might do one against Robbie and get Varun on to be the master. Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible now. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN. Reece says, have you ever looked into Titch Freeman's ridiculous run of county cricket? I get there are a lot of counting stat elements to his career, but that's a hell of a lot of wickets, especially compared to everyone else at that time. Yeah, for those who don't know, does he have the most first-class wickets? Who has the most first-class wickets in cricket? It's him. It's either he's one or two, isn't he? And I always forget which player Why has that not come up? Who is the most first class? Is what I wrote. All right, try that again. Wickets in cricket. Haustat must have it. Is it Haustat? Oh, Cricket Post got it as well. And the association. Yeah, so Rhodes has 4,204 wickets. And Titch Freeman has 3,776 wickets. I've looked at this before. It's a good one. It's on Crick Info. And I think the Association of Cricket Stats has theirs as well. So you can find, you'll be able to find it by Googling it. I'm pretty sure the only player who has played in the 2000s in the top, I don't know if this is 50 or 100. Or did he play in the 2000s? I'd say the only player, and I'm pushing modern here quite a lot, the only player that some people watching this, yeah, 2001. So there's one player to have played, to be in the top, let's say 50 first class wickets list, who has played after the year 2000. It's a good quiz question if you ever want to bring it up for Uber Cricket One nerds. But that's Courtney Walsh. So Courtney Walsh, who now I can't find, I just found his name and I've lost it again. Courtney Walsh had 1,807 wickets at 21.7. Oh dear. And that's it of modern players. There's a couple of other players not too far off his era. Bisham Beattie is there. Malcolm Marshall, I think, is another one. So there's a couple just around, you know, that period before Courtney Walsh. I'm just trying to see if there's any others. John Embry, he's another guy who did that. Intercover lumps, but I suppose a little bit earlier there. But yeah, just a ridiculous amount of wickets. Titch Freeman was a brilliant bowler, but it didn't seem that they were that interested in him in Test cricket. He plays 12 tests and takes 66 wickets at 25. It could just have been era. They did have a lot of other good finger spinners at that time, England. I'd have to go back and do a deeper dive to see exactly what the situation was. So he plays from 1920 to 1930. I mean, everything I've ever seen suggests he should have played more games, but I'm not an expert on why. But it is one of the more remarkable records that you will ever see. I mean, just the sheer amount of wickets and then to have that average as well. I think everyone thought he was a level below Clary Grimmett, but of course Clary Grimmett was the greatest bowler in the world, so you're supposed to be that. Ian says, where should the 100 stats go? I think on Crick Info they're going under T20, but that doesn't seem right. You don't bowl 10 balls straight in T20. I believe the Association of Cricket Stats and historians that we were just talking about a millisecond ago, I believe they decided it was going to go into T20 and everyone kind of followed suit with them. I don't think they should be there, but I also understand that we're getting to a dangerous point in cricket where we're going to have test, ODI, T20, 100, T10. Like, I understand that is also very, very hard to deal with. You know, we've been working on a stats project for a while of hopefully getting, you know, an advanced stats page up. Like, that will be a pain in the butt. And these things are often pains in the butt. I generally filter out the 100 when I'm looking at stuff, unless I'm looking at the 100 specifically. And that's kind of what people do anyway, I think, more often than not. I think Crick Info's got individual stats for the 100 on the player's homepage now, like all the different leagues. I can't remember if Crick Buzz, but Crick Buzz have something like that, I think, as well. So, you know, yeah, it's not perfect. Rohit says, when a top order player with keeping experience, Gowrall, Duckett, Rickleton, etc., gets out cheaply and the designated keeper, usually batting at 6 or 7, has a long innings, why can't the top order player keep wickets for a few overs at the beginning of the innings? Is the risk too high? It's a fascinating one. Shield Berry pointed this out years ago, that when England were going into games with like 2 and 3 wicket keepers, that wouldn't, and we know that wicket keepers average fewer runs towards the end of games. They have a bigger drop off than specialist batters. Wouldn't it make sense to do that? And also, wouldn't you have a wicket keeper who's better against seam bowling? And, well, I should say, wouldn't it be possible that you had a wicket keeper that was better or the same against seam bowling as the other guy? And then there was the other guy's good against spin. And so you can use one when you're going to use more pace and one when you're going to use more spin. We've got all these wicket keepers in games and we don't use it that way. I think some of it is about preparation, Rohit. I do think that is a part of it. So I think I can understand why that might not be the case. But if everyone's going to be a wicket keeper in the future, shouldn't you use the wicket keeping talent more efficiently? Right? So that can also be in T20 cricket. I would probably be interested in sides having a look at that going ahead and to see how it goes. I don't think it's close, but you never know. PJ says, Joe Angel, Sean Young, Simon Cook, Gavin Robertson, Paul Wilson, Matthew Nicholson, Scott Muller. These were amongst the almost forgotten players lucky enough to get a couple of games for the Australian team during their peak period. As a kid, I remember I had this old Whacker magazine with Joe Angel on the front that said he was going to be the next big thing. So I've always remembered his name. Also a cool name for a rock star. My memory of Joe Angel is that when he played the test match, and I could be wrong on this, but I think they played him at the Whacker and they wanted him to be like an enforcer. And I remember listening to this game on the radio. I don't even know if I watched it. I was quite young. He played 4 test matches. And I think they like, I reckon he plays against the West Indies. Yeah, 1993. Where's this test match? I think that's a fascinating one. Because I think they brought him in as like a fast bowler to bounce out the West Indies. That's my memory anyway as a kid. I haven't looked at it in a very long time. And he just wasn't that fast. At the Whacker, 1993. Let's have a look. He takes 1 wicket and goes at almost 4 runs and over. So, yeah, I'm willing to say I'm right on that. I don't think that was even the kind of bowler he was. He was a bit loose. Him and Carl Rackerman were quite similar, slightly different eras, but sort of a little bit loose but quite strong and big and would hit the spot, but their actions weren't like textbook or anything. But yeah, I don't think he was ever going to be the next big thing. Sean Young, my memory of Sean Young was he got a test for Australia because he was playing club cricket in the time and they had an injury. Simon Cook should have been a better bowler and had a lot of injuries. Gavin Robertson was just the best finger spinner available at the time. Paul Wilson, who's now an umpire, big blocker Wilson. I thought he was a good bowler, but I think he would have been a really good player in the sort of one day T20 era that we have now. But I don't know if his record would back that up. But just because of the kind of bowler he is now, he'd bowl that big heavy ball because he was so freaking huge. I never thought anyone believed he was going to be a star. And this is what I think. People sort of forget that these guys come in and out, right? Like, even in very good teams, you can go back it's the same with the West Indies. You go back to some of the old West Indies sides. There's some very random cricketers who come through. Nicholson was probably someone who wasn't quite ready. And again, a bit like Simon Cook, maybe just didn't come on the way they assumed. Scott Muller, I don't know. That was obviously the famous one. But if you go back through great sides, I think you'd be shocked at how many sort of random names pop up, you know? Like, how many games did Stuart Binney play for India, right? I'm trying to think of some other. Nicky Boye played quite a lot for South Africa. There are some players who sort of come into those sides, even when those sides are really good, you're trying to work out. Some of those players were project players as well, of like Simon Cook and Matthew Nicholson are players where they're like, well, these could work. And Paul Wilson was massive. Like, you can understand why they took some flyers on some of those guys. Mob says, there's been a heap of chatter about a New Zealand team joining the BBL, despite the lack of equity offered, and despite the negative effects that other sport amalgamations have had on developing domestic New Zealand athletes. What are your thoughts on this? I don't know as much about the domestic New Zealand athletes part of it, but I would think that New Zealand cricket is a lot stronger than league basketball and soccer in New Zealand by a long way. The little I know, I don't know as much about league or soccer, but I certainly know about basketball. And I would say that the development of that is very, very different. So you've got a better structure to do that with. I think they should have 2 sides in the BBL, and I think a north side and a south side. And I think they should be given equity. I don't think the Super Smash is really... you keep running the Super Smash, but I think the Big Bash is where I would be putting myself in. But if you don't get equity, fair to say no, they shouldn't be involved, right? Like, go away. If you think about it, Mob, then what you can do is you can filter in the players you want to those teams, which means that they can be on a high level of development. Right. And they still have the Super Smash to come back to. So it's not as if they go into a wasteland. It's like, you know, I know the Big Bash it's just a better league than Super Smash, right? It's just, if I'm running New Zealand cricket, it's almost like having an A setup, but without having to spend a lot of money on it, right? Because you should be making money back from the league. So that's the way I would look at it. Also, what's interesting there is if they do get one or two sides into the Big Bash, what happens with when the IPL owners come calling? Fascinating. Sinoy says, the rebuttal for two-tier test I often hear is that lower teams just won't play. However, if we have a 5-5 split and we take last cycle's test championship table, England would be in the second tier, then that would force England to play. And we're not going to have 5-5. There's no way the top teams are going to agree to that. Zimbabwe's playing a shitload of cricket at the moment and they can't even get elevated. So it's just nonsense to say that they wouldn't play. If it's done correctly with a TV deal, there will be money for them to play. So again, that's not a realistic argument. And they are playing and all those teams want to play more already. So it just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't really make it for me. Sashimi says, is Jaiswal the greatest Indian left-hander already? So is this one on the rounds on Twitter, didn't it? Because someone put up a message saying that Jaiswal was already better than Ganguly. Who's third on that list? Shikhar Dhawan? Trying to think of some of the older players. They just never made any left-handers, did they? Which is one of the more fascinating things in the history of cricket. There's a whole chapter on that in Nathan Lehman and Ben Jones's book, Hitting Against the Spin, which is fascinating. For some reason, it's not letting me bring up. I think if you're looking at someone's career and you just stop them now, then obviously you would pick Sourav Ganguly's career just because it's longer, right? Like, he's probably, a slightly better than replacement test batter. Let's have a look at the average. Yeah, 42. He's a slightly better than replacement test batter with specific skills that are really handy. Forget the bowling and the captaincy, although those obviously as well. But, you know, the way he played spin and everything else. I think you probably take 113 test matches at 42 over 26 test matches at 51.7. 10 times out of 10, I would take that, right? So if that's the way you're looking at it, then you take Ganguly's thing. But clearly, Jaiswal is a much better bat than Ganguly. I don't think Ganguly would argue with that, right? Maybe some like hardcore fans from Kolkata from the 90s. But no one else is really arguing that. I would assume everyone else is pretty much like, yeah, Jaiswal is a better player than him in pretty much every way that I can see. If you're just going on careers at the moment, then, you know, put it this way, 113 test matches, to play 100 test matches and average over 40 with a little bit of captaincy, with a little bit of bowling and everything else, that's such a good cricketer, right? I think because Ganguly played with other players and we know he had so many weaknesses, it's easy to make fun of him. Also, because he's kind of that guy, right? He's the rich kid who's a bit arrogant. We're going to make fun of him, right? I think that's fine. But we also have to say this is a well above average cricketer. he wasn't close to the art of batting, obviously. But I would have thought that I could have found many arguments for him being a well above average player, like without really having to do all that much work. So if you're asking me whose career I would pick, I'd pick Ganguly's. If you're asking who I'd pick on talent, I would pick Jaiswal. But I don't think that, you know, that's been the case for a year and a half, right? Like, it's become a new conversation, but I don't think specifically it's anything has changed in the last year. Jaiswal was better than him as about a year ago, right? Like, that was pretty obvious from, like, even if Jaiswal, let's say from now, or from, I don't know, 10 test matches ago, whichever mark you want to go, went on a Jimmy Adams-like drop, I think we would still go, he was more talented than Ganguly, he just didn't make the runs. So no matter how you look at it, and apologies that I couldn't bring the stats up, but if I'm sleepy on some like old left-hander, I can't think of any other left-handers that I might have missed. Brian Lara used pot plants to work on his placement. John Wright glued his glove to his bat. Sachin Tendulkar dug up practice pitches. Tatenda Taibu cut the top off his bat. Claire Taylor used a hockey grip. Steve Smith was from tennis. Dean Jones would call phantom runs. And Victor Trumper turned the nets into a war zone to survive. The best batters in the world do whatever they have to make runs. We have told their stories in our new book, The Art of Batting. Karen says, I've always been fascinated by Kevin Peterson's career arc. One of the most gifted batters for Sierra, yet someone who seemed to fall out of favour with the system. In hindsight, what exactly went wrong between Peterson and the England setup? Broadly, has the ECB historically struggled to manage and retain unconventional talents? I think everyone struggles to handle unconventional talents. I don't think there's ever been a system in the history of mankind that has been set up to handle them better. Peterson is a difficult person. He's without doubt on some spectrums, I would assume. I don't know if he's, you know, but just having met him and having watched him, I think he thinks about the world differently. He acts differently. And as someone who is neurodivergent, you kind of notice that pattern in other people. But I would also say that a lot of it is, a lot of his bravado and nonsense is trying to overcome a lack of confidence and a lack of self-worth, which goes the other way, right? And I think the people that were in charge of English cricket at that time believed that they could get him in line by bullying him and by, you know, knocking him down a peg every now and again. Also, Harmy's talked about this a lot, that I think that KP really respected some of the guys in the change room. And when they left, he kind of thought he was that guy. And that caused issues because some of the other guys thought they were that guy. And yeah, so I think there was an element of that as well. But when it comes down to it, they tried to bully him back to... I had a conversation with someone inside the inner circle about a year before all this broke down, maybe even 2 years, I can't remember. And he was telling me what they were doing, and I went, yeah, that's not going to work. And they were like, what do you mean? No. He says something, and then so-and-so says this, and that puts him back in his spot. And I went, yeah, until you can't put him in his spot. And then he's going to be, there's no one who'll be able to keep him down, right? And also, you're bullying him, and it's really obvious that you're bullying him. And they would always say the same thing. You don't understand what it's like. And I'm like, I do, because I've lived a long life and dealt with lots of people with those kinds of issues. And what I know is that if you think that you can bring them down by knocking them down a peg or by having a go at them or any of these sorts of things, they store up each and every one of those. And they're going to remember the details in a way that you never will. And then they're going to come out in several books, right? So I think it was the wrong way to manage him. I'm not sure what the right way to manage him would have been. He was a difficult person. He had problems pretty much everywhere he played. Maybe Melbourne Stars, and maybe less so in the IPL a little bit. But generally, you know, I always felt with KP, he really had to respect the person that he was kind of dealing with. And if he didn't, and then didn't feel respected back from them. Be interesting to talk to someone like Stephen Fleming, who obviously was in charge of Melbourne Stars for quite a while. But also, KP is a genius, that KP genius. KP is actually a genius, and sometimes you have to listen to him. And so if every time he stands up to tell you something, you do that, you're actually not helping yourself as a team. It was just poor. He is a difficult human being, and they were not set up to be able to handle that. And I think a lot of work has been done throughout cricket to understand this more going ahead. Ali says, are you excited by Japan's chances in the World T20? Most of their players seem to be natives. Is that a word we use, Ali? Is it too soon to get excited for a new competitive team with decent local support? I will always say the same thing. I don't give a shit where the players come from because half the original Australian team were born in England, right? Like, it's just a nonsense thing to worry about that, Ali. South Africa were basically England light for decades, man. You just weren't there, right? Like, eventually, it happens. As Ireland's maybe one of the best... modern stories of this, where the old Irish teams had plenty of players in from other countries, and now they are producing their own players. I've said for ages that I think Japan can do something in cricket. I think if you like baseball and they like that sort of stuff, cricket is like a nerdier version of baseball in many ways, right? Like, you know, it's like a colonial version of baseball. So I can understand why people in Japan would get obsessed and would get involved with it. And there's no reason why athletically they shouldn't be able to play cricket. I don't know enough about their team to tell you whether they're going to do good or not. But yeah, every time there's a new team in a World Cup, we're all going to race over and have a look. They've got some good kits. And I do think good kits is the way to start. Ajit says, why do teams, especially T20 franchises, not have definite home and away kits? Is it simply because not all 11 players from both sides take the field at once? It's because you're not ever passing the ball to someone, right? So you don't, clash kits don't matter. That's the main reason we do it. Well, we don't do it, I suppose, is the best way of putting it. I still think it's a missed opportunity not to have two kits, but like from a sales perspective, from a marketing perspective. But that's the reason we don't do it. But it was hilarious. I was watching Bangladesh, South Africa yesterday, just going, the wicketkeeper and the batter just look exactly the same to me. It's ridiculous. Yeah, so we should just do it. I just think it makes more sense. If the part of the whole reason of having those colors is, to make it easier for casual fans, and then we go out of our way to make it harder just because a lot of teams have the same colors. Every cricket team in the world should have a dark color and a light color, right? That's as simple as that. I think it would be awesome. Sell more shirts. As someone who collects cricket shirts and loves cricket shirts, there is not enough cricket shirts in the world. That's what I would say. More designs. Where's the Jaffna Stallions when you need them? Reese says, I've always found Paul Collingwood a weird player to find or understand in historical context. Is he just average when we look back at it? Or was he, alongside KP, Freddie, one of the England's first really good all-format players? I think he was a very averagely talented player who maximized almost every part of what he did, fielding, batting, bowling. Bowling is obviously his weakest skill, but he could still, you look at him in one day, and he's bowled, he's got 100 wickets in one day cricket. Like, he really shouldn't have done that. And I think a lot of it was, it's funny because he's not known as a professional person off the field, but on the field, it just felt like he was the sort of person who went out of his way to maximize each individual thing. He was, I will say this, if he had any elite skill, he was an elite athlete at a time when England didn't really create elite athletes, right, in cricket. And he stood out from that perspective. I think he was probably someone who was very good on flat pitches when he batted and played on a lot of flat pitches in Test cricket in that era, or flatter pitches. If you have a look at his Test record, it's much better than his first class record. And I think that's just because the wickets were better, especially in Durham when he played. One day cricket, probably a little bit slow with the bat to be considered an all format. What did you call him? An all format? Wait, let me just go back. First really good. Yeah. I'm not sure I'd have him as a really good all format player. I'd have him as a solid all format player. And he couldn't replicate anything in T20 cricket, could he? He's almost a bowler in T20 cricket rather than a batter. Kind of bizarre career for him when it came to that. But I think he was definitely a very good player and a very good professional. And I always use him as the sort of the default of, like, that's your kind of your arch role player, right? Like, just does a lot of things right and is, you can always rely on them with bat, with ball, or in the field. PJ says, Dom Bess, has he been leached and Bashir'd? Will he ever play for England again? They don't create a lot of spinners, so there's always a chance he'll play for England again. Was he leached or Bashir'd? He was Bashir'd. They knew he wasn't that good technically. They thought there was something about him. That was honestly the sort of chat they would say when I would be like, hey, I'm not sure he's mechanically sound. I'm not sure he can bowl a decent, repeatable off spinner. They really liked the kind of kid he was. And I always heard good stories. I don't think I've ever met Dom Bess, but I've always heard good stories about, you know, confident guy, not in a bad way, but like believed in himself, had a little bit about him, you know, believed he should be playing on that level. Not everyone does believe that, especially young finger spinners from non-Asian countries are not always that confident. Could bat a little bit, I think, was also the other part of it. I think they always knew that he wasn't going to be a specialist full-time bowler in international cricket. But a lot of it's just, it's how do you continue to develop those guys, right? Like, he doesn't always get the opportunities. He sort of, has bounced around. What are we up to? Three county sides. Yeah, I want to say three county sides at this point. He's not always a first 11 player, I believe. I hope I'm right in saying that. But certainly he's more of a fringe first. Maybe fringe is wrong. I think that there's always possibility. He's, 26 now? 28 now. He's the sort of player, maybe like a young Gareth Batty, who just later on in his career works out how to bowl. And maybe gets slightly better technically and comes back as a better player. Because I do think there is something about him as a professional. The fact that he hasn't like disappeared and he's still taking wickets in his domestic career, I think is a very, very good sign for the sort of person and the sort of player and professional he is. He's just not that good at bowling off spin. And he never was that good at bowling off spin. And sadly, he took wickets early that made him look like he was better, which Mountaineers he's remembered worse, when actually they knew he wasn't that good in the first place. That, you know, it was a Bashir-type situation. And he doesn't quite have the... His best ball is nowhere near as good as Bashir or Moeen Ali's. And he doesn't have the consistency of Jack Leach. And he can't bat like Moeen Ali. So he's kind of stuck in this... let me just quickly look at his batting average in first-class cricket. Average is 25 in first-class cricket. That's like a handy number 9. Maybe you could stretch that to number 8. No, you probably should be able to bat about a normal number 8 level in Test cricket, which is good. Take that. But it's not enough with your bowling. So, look, I think people are going to look back at his record and be like, why didn't he play more? But, you know, he took that ridiculous, I want to say a 5-wicket haul against Sri Lanka, which was the stupidest 5-wicket haul I've ever seen. Let me just think. There was Michael Clark. I think Tom Bess is right up there. It was a remarkably weird one. All right, let's just finish up here with a couple of super chats, and then we'll all head into the sunset. Let's call it that. Andy says, have your views on Brevis evolved over the last couple of years? What are his strengths and weaknesses and upside? No, I just thought he wasn't ready and everyone was saying he was ready. So I don't think anything I've ever, you'd have to go back and check, Andy. So I might be slightly misremembering this, but he just wasn't ready. I just didn't think he was developed enough. I don't think he played enough cricket. I don't think he understood his own game. I think Tristan Stubbs was the one I was lower on. I think with Stubbs, I was a bit like, I don't know. I see some good things and I see some bad things. I think with Brevis, I always went, he can smash the ball. He's got a good technique. He's a pretty good athlete. Like, there's a lot of pluses with him, but it just was clear he went to the IPL way too early. He just wasn't anywhere near ready you compare him to Luhan Pretoria, where I look at Luhan Pretoria and I'm like, I can see him as a player who you could have a go on in the IPL, and because he has enough batting smarts, he'll be able to work it out for a little while, even if he doesn't start. But I just thought with Dale Brevis, he just hadn't even played enough first-class cricket. He just looked like someone who hadn't played enough. His ball striking is ridiculous. His ability to commit to a method, I think, is really, really good, and I like that. I just think he's a huge talent. Jack says, I've always assumed the biggest challenge for the Australian women would be they'd eventually get tired of winning, but they seem to be immune to winning fatigue as well. Is winning fatigue not a thing? I don't think it's a thing. I always thought the thing, I think we all believed that once the WPL came in, once Women's 100 came in, once women started playing franchise cricket around the world, they would professionalize and catch up to the Australian team. We just expected that to happen. It has not happened. Maybe it's still too early. Maybe we're 2 or 3 years away from it. But it's not happened, right? Like, we all know it hasn't happened. They've got Jess Johnson is not here. Like, they've got fantastic fast bowling options that are not available. They've got specialists that they could use that are not here. There's so much talent that is not in this side. And look at them. They're ridiculous. You know, I just did a podcast with Robbie. It's just like, when do you see a team with this kind of depth? It's just not something that you see all that often. Andy says, are India the best T20 batting side? Australia have better roll definition, more power and fewer weaknesses. India's edge is a modern batting lineup with Bumrah and the spinners. I'm trying to think of the two lineups. I think India's the better batting lineup. Yeah, I think they're the better batting lineup than Australia. Pretty sure. I'd have to have a look at the numbers and go through the teams a little bit, but I think I have them as marginal. I still really like the Australian batting lineup as well, but I think India is probably slightly better. Samit says, Patrick on the Caribbean Cricket Podcast said West Indies should woo Saudi for funds. Would something like hosting a marquee test T20 either be realistic? And with the West Indies batting struggles, why not follow New Zealand and flatten domestic pitches and grow batters? Yeah, the second one, I've said it 1,000 times to me. So many times I've said it. I would start there more than anything else. The Saudi thing's interesting. there is a bit of money that's come into West Indies cricket before via China, right? So in some ways, they have already gone down this path. A lot of the stadiums are built by China. And Taiwan? Certainly China. There's one that's not China that might be another Asian country as well. So yeah, there is an element of they've done that before. And the stadiums, I mean, don't get me wrong. The Grenada Stadium, I'm trying to think of some of the others that were built with that money. Like, it's good to have a better stadium. But I wonder how many millions went into those stadiums when actually maybe you could have gone into developing cricket at the lower level, which would have been better. Yeah. Would the money still have been given to them for that? I don't know. And maybe not, right? Like, I don't know how these things work. But yeah, there's definitely an element of fix the pitches so that people can bat. Like, I'm just going to keep saying it. Right across the Caribbean, from club cricket all the way up, pitches need to be better. Honestly, I'm at this stage where I'm like, if you replaced all Caribbean pitches with synthetic wickets, I honestly think there would be an uptick in batting in Test cricket and probably all cricket in the Caribbean. Hassan says, more than 70% of Bubba's dismissals in the last 4 years are balls coming in. Has he changed his stance or does it look like a lack of error or judgment? Hassan, we've done a whole piece on this. Essentially, what was happening is when he was batting really well, he was occasionally nicking off sort of back of the length, just outside off stump, because his front foot, his left foot, was on leg stump. And because it takes you a little bit longer to get to those balls outside off stump, he was a little bit late to them and he was nicking off. So what he did was is he moved himself to be more square on. So his front shoulder, instead of facing mid on or the non-striker, is now facing the umpire. And he moved across the stumps, which means that now when you bowl at the stumps, he's kind of locking himself off. That is what happened. We've done a video on it. It's been talked about quite a bit, that video. It was shared with him and other people and involved with them. They're all aware of it. I think they're now just like, how do we actually fix this issue? Because he probably doesn't feel comfortable going back to the old method, and the new method's not particularly working either. And that's the issue sometimes when you have these problems. Anurag says, what do India want to achieve with Nitesh Kumar ready in test? He averages 24 in first class with the bat and like 30 with the ball, bowling mid-120s. He's tall either. I don't see how he can ever justify his place. He's obviously a better bat than 24 first-class batting average. They want him to average 35 to 37 with the bat in Test cricket. And that's era-dependent, of course. So you can bring that down to this current era. That might be 33 to 35, where he's not a negative with the bat, and they want his bowling to develop to the point where he can take wickets. I'm not too worried about the 120 kilometers an hour. If he becomes Colin de Grandhomme, right? So what's Colin de Grandhomme's numbers? I feel like this has been a very me Googling things. Colin de Grandhomme, in Test cricket, he averages 38 with the bat. That's actually really good, by the way, especially batting at number 7. Oh. And he averages 33 with the ball. Okay, so let's make that slightly more. We'll change the shape of that, and we'll make it 33 with the bat and 31 with the ball. 30 with the ball. That's a really good player. How many overs he can bowl, whether he's going to be fast enough, whether he can bowl in all places, can he bowl in India? All valid questions, Anurag. But if you're asking what they want to achieve with him, that's what they want to achieve. Now, that's the A-tier level of Nitesh Kumar Reddy. That's a good cricketer. That's Shane Watson, right? Slightly more on the... Yeah, no, it's a Shane Watson. That's fine. The S-tier level of that cricketer is that he's talented enough to average 40 with the bat and average 28 with the ball, right? So what's that? Tony Gregg-ish numbers? I don't think he has the skills to do that. But I also don't see two or three other guys coming through the system where they have that. So if they end up with the A tier or even the B tier, what's the B tier? 31 with the bat, 35 with the ball. That's handy when they need to bring him into the side. That's three different versions that they're all going to get something out of. I think it reminds me of what Mike Selvey said years ago about England and Sam Curran, when he said, do England know what they have in Sam Curran? And I think Nitesh Kumar Reddy is very similar. Does India know what they have? And they have to be really, really clear with exactly what he is. You can't bat him at number 8 and bowl him 15 overs a game, right? You're not getting anything out of that. Do you know what you have, right? And then where do you fit him into the side? And if that's the case, they have to be realistic. I don't think him, Jadeja, Washington, Sundar need to be in the same side as each other. I don't know what you have. You've got a guy at 6 and a guy at 7 there who are both better, probably at this stage, better at batting than he is. So you don't need him, right? But when you don't have Washington in the side, he comes in at number 7. Then you know what you have, right? Know exactly what you want to use him for. And I would say that to all people and all teams and everyone across all the lands. That's Jared Kimber here on the Good Areas Live. We've just done a video on Elise Perry, which I'm really, really proud of. I think it's a really interesting piece. Sometimes it's really hard to do the big features on the people that everyone have covered a million times before. But I thought there was something that really needed to be spoken about when it comes to Elise Perry and her career and everything else. And hopefully we've done that. So head over to the main page and do that. We've got some Nat Siver Brunt content. We've got some Rohit the ODI batter content coming up. There's some things. There's always some things. There's lots of things. This is a things place. Good Areas a things place. Like, subscribe, Patreon, do all those things. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.